Someone wouldn't let us win. They wouldn't let us win. They were called the superdelegates.
It's over, Johnny. You have to stop harassing women now. It's over. Do you hear me? This operation is over.
I never wanted to harass them. And then, but when I come back, some puke at the airport is calling me harasser and other vile crap like that. It wasn't my fight.
You're the last of an elite unit, Johnny. Brunig, Renson, they're all dead. You're the only one left.
No, it's episode 13, guys. Episode 13 of Chapo Trap House, and we opened with a little bit of what I like to call Rambo Thirst Blood, Rambo Thirst Blood Part 2, because I think John Rambo is like the perfect analog for the brave, loyal Bernie bro, who, you know, didn't want a war, but when people started one. They gave you a war you wouldn't believe, and now they've been abandoned and let go. But we salute all of them on our show. On today's show, we're talking with Connor Kilpatrick of Jacobin Magazine about Bernie Sanders and the Democratic Party, and all the various issues of why what Bernie Sanders means and why the Democratic Party is worthless. And we got him to admit that he supports Hillary and is ready for her. So we're going to make some news in that regard.
We also broke the story about Connor. He is taking a job at the Center for American Progress. And we are joining him. We are rebranding as the Discourse Trap House. And we're replacing all rap references in the show's intro. Except we will have... Macklemore for sure, but that's it.
I'm going to call it the Chapo Wonk House, but we're gonna figure it out one way.
Well, we still gotta work, we gotta workshop it, folks, but the lesson of today's show is if you can't beat them, join them.
Yeah. Look, we're out here, we're outclassing all the beta boys. We're going, anyone who disagrees with the new direction of the show, we will show your tweets to the concierge at the hotel or the waiter, and they will laugh at how ignorant the trolls are. We'll be laughing.
We have the federal police on speed dial.
Yeah, like we honestly don't care what you think at all. We haven't been thinking about it. We haven't been worried about it since we announced this new direction of the show. It's frankly funny to us that you people are criticizing us, calling us fellas.
Okay, but it's time for the thirst blood. I think it's time to give these folks a war that they won't believe. What do you say? Start the show?
Let's do it.
Chapo, let's go. Okay, we are back. As I said before, it's Chapo Trap House, episode 13. Good luck 13, as I like to call it. It's me, Will Meneker. Joining me, as you just heard, is Matt Christman.
Hey, folks.
And Felix Peterman.
Hey, everybody.
How you guys doing?
Not bad. I did 4x8 squats today, back squats, with two plates. Weird choice to make. Legs are a bit tired. One for weight rather than volume. You can hear more about this on my lifting podcast, The Irony Bar.
I walked up some stairs today, but other than that, things are good as hell. We're doing great here in the Trap House. Thanks again to all our Chapo Grey Wolf subscribers. I believe we are at almost 900 now, so maybe this week let's crack 1K and then just keep it going from there. Now, I bring this up because if you are a Grey Wolf subscriber, you will be familiar with our premium show last week where we discussed the hilarious presidential campaign of David French of the National Review, Bill Kristol's dark horse candidate to unseat Trump and rally the Never Trump bow tie brigade and the 101st Bathroom Warriors. But since then, as exactly as we said was going to happen, David French bitched out and decided not to run for president at all, because even he knew...
His heart pumped Kool-Aid.
Even he knew how fucking stupid it was.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of shocked it petered out like it did. Usually, Americans respond big to a World of Warcraft player who's terrified as much of trans people in bathrooms as he is of Christian men emailing his wife about Ephesians so they can put one in her back. But hey, just goes to show, you never know what people will want. That's why you have focus groups.
Sorry, our dream of having an independent conservative run for president is still on hold. But again, it went down exactly like we said we would. It said it would, that David French wouldn't even get a sniff at running for president. But I just
and
do want to read...
I believe that it had something to do with the art show. I think he heard it, and I think his skin just got even whiter than it is currently, which you wouldn't think was possible. And he was just like, I'm out. I can't handle these guys.
For the people who aren't subscribers, we did a reading from some of the David French oeuvre on the premium show that was hilarious. But I just want to read a little bit now for you guys from his post in the National Review titled, I'm Not Running for President. And the headline is, I'm not the right person to challenge Trump and Hillary, but the path remains open for others. And he's just holding the door like a polite gentleman. It's very self-pitying and self-aggrandizing, as you might imagine. But in our premium show, we did read from his eulogy for Prince, where at one point he said, it's easy to get famous in America playing guitar, but like real heroes just like, you know, toil away in obscurity. And he was obviously talking about himself. So I just want to read one of his closing paragraphs here. He writes, and the fight is not over. Men such as my friend and colleague, Boston filmmaker and philanthropist John Kingston, stand ready to continue the effort. So yeah, that's one person even more obscure than he is.
Yeah, that is the shittiest name drop ever. Like, says, my friend made a documentary about the hero who threw the flag at the black guy during the busing riot. John Kingston, you may have heard of him. He's a documentarian, by the way.
No, he just says, John Kingston, he has substantial resources behind him. But he goes on, he writes...
he has two cars, his dishwasher.
He says, we live in a time where patriots are mocked and demagogues are celebrated. Again, talking about himself, patriots like me are mocked for our utterly ludicrous fantasy about running for president.
But it's just because we go to public bathrooms with samurai swords.
He says, even good men have reduced themselves to excusing the inexcusable and defending the indefensible. It's like, you know, it's like the Falcon cannot hear the Falconer for David French here.
Hey, shit, Dick, you're not writing a dark Batman movie.
He says, to those of you who prayed for me and my family, I am grateful beyond words. And it was actually their prayers which helped him realize how fucking dumb this was, and that he just needed to, like, save face as quickly as possible before this, you know, poor Bill Kristol took it, you know, too seriously.
He walked into his backyard and a bush lit on fire and said, everyone is laughing about your wife email thing. You're a fucking weirdo.
He says... he goes on, to those who defended my wife and kids from vicious attacks, engaging in a fight you didn't seek, I'm forever in your debt.
Dude, so, nobody made fun of your wife and kids.
They're making fun of you,
yeah.
Dude.
We feel bad for your wife and kids.
They all do that. They all lay out their weird mutant worldviews, and then people make fun of them. They're like, wow, me and my family have been under this barrage of... No, motherfucker! It's the rhetorical version of Pederis putting his stupid kid in his avatar.
I mean, I guess people attacked his wife and kids by making fun of their failure husband and dad. Yeah. But
if you're talking about him, it's like who would marry him? Then that's sort of an implicit in criticism of the wife.
I like how he said, "I am forever in your debt." Like, can you think of a shittier debt? To be owed. Like, oh, great. David French is on my side. He can't help me fix my car or, like, get my kid into college or anything.
I guarantee you David French thinks that the Iraqi people, like, owe him a debt for volunteering to be in the JAG Corps when he was, like, 50 years old. But One last bit here from David French's bidding adieu to his presidential hopes. He says, as I've written many times before, nations are built on virtue and courage is indispensable. But there is also prudence. And it was simply not prudent for me to take on this task. Roll the audio again of Spike Jonze saying, I think I'm scared.
You're scared, right?
Maybe.
So that was quite an artful bitching out, David, if I do say so. Prudence and courage are the two things that nations and deluded World of Warcraft playing bathroom warriors are built on.
If there was one thing that the framers of the Constitution had, Hamilton especially, it was prudence. That was my favorite song from Hamilton. Prudence. It's the opposite of rudeness. I'm going to do this.
So, once again, farewell to David French. Once again, we made
toilet flush sound.
We made it happen, and then we flushed his ass down the toilet. We built him up and then destroyed him.
So yeah, whichever 12th string mutant comes out of the sewer to try to claim his mantle, just know that we're going to smack your ass down like whack-a-mole.
Okay. Should we go into this interview with Connor Kilpatrick, a.k.a. Colonel Troutman?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay. So, first question, what is Jacobin Magazine's official policy about the gorilla? Was Harambe a class traitor or revolutionary martyr?
I wouldn't even be able to say. I can't speak for Jacobin. I'm just I'm the Joe Biden of Jacobin Magazine. I meet and greet, I go to funerals, you know.
You touch women.
I touch women, I grope them in taverns, smile a lot, I cram tubed meat into my mouth. That's basically it.
I imagine they don't hire too many women because, like, you know. But do you just get docked pay and suspended, or do you get fired if you're a woman and you don't smile? Because sweeties do all the smiles.
See, you know, this is what drives me nuts. In all seriousness, it's hilarious because, I mean, Jacobin's founded by a first-generation Trinidadian American. The number two person who has the most power is Ramique, who was born in, you know, Jamaica, grew up in East New York. So I always find it so fucking funny that this line, it's just like with Bernie Sanders, where it's like, it doesn't matter that his base is young women. Right? They're just going to say it's angry white men.
Well, so. I mean, Connor, this is a Chapo fact check. Connor is lying. Jacobin was founded by Hunter Moore and Joe Francis of Girls Gone Wild, who used their misogyny dollars to find the political system that is most misogynistic. No.
We wanted to have you on to talk about a lot of things, obviously, sort of Bernie, the Bernie bros, Hillary, and, you know, what this means for the future of the Democratic Party. But I want to begin with bringing up an article that you wrote back in May that was titled Burying the White Working Class, and the subhead is Liberal Condescension Towards White Workers is Code for a Broader Anti-Working Class Agenda.
That's right.
You write, after decades of being told white workers would never support socialism because they're racist, we're now told that they support the socialist candidate because they're racist. And this is, I think, the fundamental contradiction that you're trying to portray here. So could you sort of give us some background on why you wrote this article and, like, the sort of where you were trying to go with it?
Well, I wrote the article because, I mean, it's been simmering. It had been simmering for a while. But it was when the West Virginia vote came in, and the line immediately from the pundit class was that, you know, the overwhelming Sanders victory in this white state in West Virginia was because it was actually they were somehow voting for Bernie for any other reason but that they wanted a more egalitarian society. So they came up with this, you know, strange concoction in which they were voting for Bernie because Hillary is the continuation of Obama, and they dislike Obama because he's black. So that was kind of driving me nuts. But I'd wanted to write about all this before, because this narrative that I see liberals push on the white workers is just getting increasingly stupid, and they're pushing it extra hard during the Bernie Sanders thing. And that narrative is this: this is narratives that the Democratic Party moved away from economic populism. It moved to the right because in 1980, white workers, particularly in the South, all decided, I don't have any interest in the New Deal or any kind of social democratic policies. I'd rather sit at home and write KKK all the way on a notebook, or I'd rather go vote for Reagan. And the thing is, there's no fucking evidence for this. Like, there is no evidence that that the white working class all suddenly decided they'd rather become Republicans than vote for their own material self-interest. And I got annoyed because I realized what ended up actually happening was some white workers started voting GOP in the South, but most either stopped voting because of the awfulness of Jimmy Carter's right-wing turn, or most, like my grandfather, kept voting for the Democratic Party. And so it's a totally made-up narrative that's designed to ignore capital flight, the war on labor, the crisis of capitalism in the 1970s, and it's basically the whole thing is designed to say, well, the Democratic Party became worthless because it's the fault of this big segment of the working class. So the Democratic Party was forced to become a party of white collar professionals and neoliberals, and that pisses me off.
I mean, it's an incredibly circular argument because, okay, their argument is that every single white working class voter abandoned the Democratic Party after after civil rights.
It's not even true.
It's not even true. But okay, accept that for a second. Pretend that is even fucking true.
Right.
All right. So fast forward to 2016. Bernie Sanders does incredibly well in West Virginia. He destroys with independents.
And Indiana, too.
Indiana, all these places in Michigan, he cleans up with independents. So even if you're a Democrat bemoaning the loss of this large voting bloc, wouldn't you think, oh, wow, all these people that in this alternate timeline that every fucking idiot seems to subscribe to, these people are flocking back to a Democratic candidate.
Like, yeah, why don't they want them back?
But right, but because they're insane, but because these people are fucking craven idiots, they think that instead of a good candidate swaying this block of people that they thought they had lost, swaying them back to the party, back to the general movement, they think that just their presence like makes Bernie Sanders racist. Like that just being around them, Bernie is like, oh, you know what? Malcolm X got what was coming to him. All those white people voted for me. Yeah, I'm racist now. I'm proud to be racist.
You write in the article, quote, despite off-the-charts wealth and equality, Democratic Party liberals have been concerned not with an egalitarian reckoning to unite the have-nots against the haves, but with inclusion, bringing different interest groups into the professional class while managing everyone else's expectations downward. It brings to mind something, I heard John Dolan say on the War Nerd this week that really stuck with me. But he said that, like, if you look at the Clintons and, like, really everything they represent, it's all about starting from the assumption that the Republicans own America, and that America is essentially a conservative country. There's no going back on that. And that the role of the Democrats and themselves in particular is to kind of negotiate to mitigate the absolute worst effects of just unfettered, revanchist conservative.
And it's really funny how that's a belief that was the exact opposite just 50, 60 years ago. I mean, the whole Buckleyite wing of the Republican Party emerged out of the crisis of the late 40s, early 50s, where their realization of, oh shit, Like, we have no prospects for being a majority party in this country. You know, like, that at that time, the assumption was the exact opposite of the same country.
But let's be clear. It's like, it's totally not true. Like, if you look and it's not, I don't think it's ever been true. I mean, Noam Chomsky's been talking about this for like 25 years now. When you look at polls and you poll people, kind of taking out some of the really politicized framings, there's a moderate social democratic consensus in this country, and there has been for a long time. I mean, that's why Bernie's had the success he's had, because basically everybody's felt this, but they've been made to feel, you know, they're alone and they're the only ones that think this way. And the media certainly does a good job of making them feel that way. But by pretending that there's these mobs of that, you know, we're all on Republican turf, and that, you know, this is the best they can do, it kind of keeps this, you know, enables them to kind of be this ruling class servant party, which is what they are, without ever having to deliver to, like, their labor union constituency. I mean, remember when Obama had 60 votes in the Senate?
No card check.
Yeah, no, like, he
no card check.
He campaigned on EFCA, and as soon as he had 60 votes in the Senate, everyone is saying, you know what, now's not the time. The biggest financial crisis of the Great Depression is apparently not the time for, you know, more unionization. He immediately abandoned it, even though he had, you know, they had 60 votes. So I think it's really important to remember that these narratives, you know, that white workers are all racist and that's why they abandoned the Democratic Party. This is center-right country. This is the best we can do. These are all, everyone's invested in pushing this. Right outside your front door, I tell ya, out where they'll kill ya, you could use a friend. Where the road ends, that's the place for me, where I'm me in my own space, where I... So on the one hand, you have, like, you know, as we just talked about, like, the kind of fundamental unwillingness of the Democratic Party to be the party of this social democratic consensus for a lot of reasons.
Exactly.
But at the same time, are still very invested in like both the votes and money of kind of educated urban liberals. So, like,
right,
is the flip side of that what they're offering in, you know, in lieu of, you know, healthcare or labor rights? Is this kind of increasing reliance on identity politics? Like, is that where this thing about how racist the white people who don't vote for them are? Is that where that comes in? Does it give some kind of balm to the white people who do vote for them?
Yeah, I think so. And it also, I mean, at this point, and I honestly, before the Sanders campaign, I'm not even sure I would have gone this far. I actually think that most of the time when these bourgeois liberals just be like, white working class people, you know them, they're racist. I mean, it's, in, you know, Vivek Chibber at NYU was talking to me about this, and he really thinks it's basically, it's an acceptable way to hate the poor and hate the working class is to just, you know, just blanketly describe white workers as, you know, just a bunch of racist. And, you know, it's without any proof. Think about it. Like, they never produce anything to show proof that, you know, these people are all just, you know, they'd rather burn a cross than have Medicare. They just say it. So I'm sorry. I think every wildly unequal society comes up with a narrative to the enlightened ruling class that gives them permission to despise the lower orders. And that's, you know, you see this in the United States and in Europe at the turn of the century with the kind of rise of social Darwinism and, you know, these narratives like that. I think that's what this, I think a lot of this rhetoric is. I mean, certainly there is a lot of racism in, among white workers, just like there's a lot of, you know, this is a racist society, but you don't, the way you defeat that is you get them involved in a project of solidarity with, you know, with people of color who are workers. Like, that's how you fight racism, right? You don't just say, you don't hand out a national scantron to workers saying, like, you know, show what a great person you are, then maybe we'll think about, you know, pushing a social democratic set of policies to make your life better. No, you take people as they are and you get them involved in, you know, like labor politics, and that's how you create solidarity. Right? Like, solidarity yeah. is the result of these things.
And, like, the thing is, like, you know, these splits in people's identity between men and women, between black and white, between, you know, religious or non-religious, like, I think most people don't even know their own hearts, let alone other people's.
Exactly.
And asking them to, you know, bridge that gap or, like, you know, speak to someone else's experience or, you know, live that other experience is... impossible. And I don't think, you know, most individuals are ready to even do that to themselves. But the one experience that is shared by most people is having to make money to live.
Right.
And being expected to work to justify their existence within the society, or having to go to a doctor. And right. like, I think those are the things in which politics can be most productive at
these
uniting people.
Solidarity. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if this narrative was true, then how is it that, you know, even under a Jim Crow society, labor unions successfully organized black and white workers together. I mean, that was a Jim Crow society. So if we were able to create solidarity, workers were able to find solidarity amongst themselves, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, are you honestly telling me that some, you know, 42-year-old white dude in Indiana is just so – he's just, like, even more invested in, you know, racism than his equivalent – in the 30s and 40s? No, it's ridiculous. It's designed... the people saying this don't want a social democratic party. They don't want social democratic policies. They don't.
Well, the move they made to sort of elide this is they did a lot of sleight of hand. After West Virginia, which is, of course, you know, the impetus for a lot of this discussion, was... So Sanders won West Virginia, and that was a problem. So the fact that Trump also won West Virginia was just sort of shuffled to – they were both shuffled together as like it was one group of voters who voted for both of them. Even though – even in West Virginia, I'm pretty sure you only get to mark one name on the ballot. And the people who voted for Trump are not the same people who voted for Sanders. Trump and Sanders voters in this argument get smooshed together to be the same people.
Right, and that's intentional. I mean, a lot was made out of the fact that Bernie in West Virginia won voters who wanted more conservative policies than Obama, but they don't mention that he won even a bigger share of voters who wanted more liberal policies. But they also forget to mention that to a working class person in West Virginia, what the fuck do these terms more liberal, more conservative means? I mean, a more liberal policy to them might mean, you know, more soda taxes, right? It might mean more Harvard Law. And honestly, I think that's frankly, I think that's a better description of what liberalism is in 2016 than the New Deal.
Yeah, those definitions have completely – this is what this election has done. This is like the one really productive thing, no matter what happens, that's come out of this election, is that these facile categories that have absolutely dominated politics for the last 30 years have totally fallen apart. Like liberal, right. moderate, conservative, they don't mean anything anymore. And everyone kind of finally realizes that there has to be some sort of interrogation of the undergirding ideological structures. And it's not just, you know, what the affectations of certain people in given classes, you know, take upon themselves to sort of signal that they're conservative or liberal or whatever. Like shit like, you know, going to Chick-fil-A versus going to whatever, I don't know. What's the
Chipotle.
What's the, Chipotle, right, yeah. I keep forgetting what the liberal Chipotle or Chick-fil-A is. It's Chipotle.
I mean, some professional in Massachusetts might work in, you know, the medical tech industry and make $250,000 a year and write down that he's a very liberal person because he knows what white privilege is and he checks his frequently. But when you ask him, like, hey, how do you feel about Medicare for All? He's like, it's unworkable. Or if you ask him how he feels about labor unions, he's like, they're outmoded. They need to be disrupted. So in a way, he is very – that's like he is very liberal, right? But that doesn't make him in any way left-wing. So,
and, you know, I mean, this is obviously sort of a different point of discussion, the foreign policy aspect. But, God, I argued with this. There was a fucking guy that I argued with who just constantly harped on the supposed left-wing fetishization of the white worker and how it was racist and all the supporters were racist and had a racial blind spot. I had an argument with the same person about arms sales to Saudi Arabia, and he said, do you really give a shit about dead foreigners?
Look at all you have to know about these people's supposed racial sensitivity is their attitude towards foreign policy. Hillary Clinton, the candidate these people support, voted and promoted the Iraq War, which they just say, hey, get over it. Hey, people made mistakes. This act that has thrown Iraq into a civil war they'll probably have for at varying levels of intensity for another 100 fucking years. It has caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. It doesn't matter because they're foreigners. And the moment that you go outside U.S. borders, their mask slips off and they're just a bunch of dead Muslims to these people.
Right. They don't give a fuck. I mean, who was that journalist that said, hey, how did you guys feel about that?
John Aravosis is not a journalist. He's not a journalist. He is a target of child assault and a blogger. He's not a fucking journalist. I don't know what he is.
Yeah, it blew my mind.
I don't know what he
is. Three kids got on each other's backs and tried to strangle him to death. And sadly did not succeed.
I mean, it just blew my mind because that's how they're treating the Iraq war in this election. It's like, oh, okay, she made a bad call. I mean, it was like kind of my political awakening, right? I remember,
yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
And in 2007, 2008, you know, I liked John Edwards. He seemed like more left-wing, but I was an Obamaphile because Obama had been staunchly against the war. John Edwards had voted for that Iraq war. That, to me, it's like that was all I needed to know. And so this idea that's...
When you look back at the Obama campaign and it's all that rhetoric about bringing people together and transcending partisanship is pretty embarrassing and stupid. But the core idea of one of these people voted for the Iraq war, one of them's publicly opposed it, that was the thing. That's what made this decision easy.
Oh, it was
no-brainer. I voted for Obama. I was 18 and I was really excited because when I was a kid, when I was like 12, 13, one of the things that drove me fucking crazy was the Iraq War, where growing up, it seemed like everyone in America seemed like they had lost their fucking minds. And, you know, Bush would stumble. You know, this is another thing that John Dolan talks about, but he sums it up very well, where Bush would stumble through a speech and just look terrified the whole time, and people would go, wasn't that great? Because you did a great job. And you would just go, what the fuck is wrong with you?
I was in Texas.
And then we dove headfirst into Iraq, and all these supposed liberal people were talking about how we need to do nation building. And did you just, even as a kid, I was pulling my fucking hair out.
Right.
Because this seemed like the most obvious thing in the world, and then Obama comes, and you're like, oh my God, finally, I can finally vote. This Democrat I can vote for who is against this.
Exactly. Right, and it's kind of funny that I mean, who were the senators that voted against the war? I mean, you had Robert Byrd, right?
Like Russ Feingold.
Racist. By the way, racist. Robert Byrd, racist. Actual racist.
You know, Rush Limbaugh. My mom was a big Rush Limbaugh listener, so I heard him all the time as a kid. But I did think it was funny. Rush always calls Senator Byrd. He always called him Sheets.
that's kind of funny.
The Sheets.
That's good. Did he think of that while he was on a sex tour in Thailand?
Probably.
I want to come back around to something, to this idea about lowering and raising expectations, because I think an important thing that you do in the article is that it's not so much that Hillary is lowering them, it's that Bernie is raising them. And I think that's what's driving these people so crazy. Like, you know, he's taking at face value the exact opposite thing that they believe. You know, he's saying that, like, people, I'm operating from the point of view that, like, It's crazy that we don't have a single payer healthcare system in this country. They're like, this is a very basic matter of something that every other civilized country manages to do. There's no reason we can't have one in this country. And I just, like, when I think about this, the thing that brings to mind is like when I talk to people who support Clinton, who are, you know, like, you know, parents or friends or people who are a little bit older of like sort of older Democrats or liberals, the argument that comes up over and over again from people who aren't crazy, right?
Right.
Is this idea that, well, you know, I like Bernie, but, you know, really, he wouldn't be able to get anything done. You know, I think it would be a disaster. Like, I think Hillary knows how to get things done.
Yeah.
And, I guess my response to this is I don't, with this current Republican Congress, I don't want the next president to get anything done.
Yeah. I mean, what is get something done is going to be, you know, privatized Social Security. I mean,
exactly.
Let's not forget that Bill Clinton was raring to go. His big second administration, initiative was going to be reforming Social Security. That was blown up by the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So
Obama was raring to go on a grand bargain too, but the House caucus was so insanely right that he couldn't get
no. I think
we were saved. We were saved by a Social Security gutting by like 15 hillbilly psychopaths named Dortch Borgnal, who said, "I'm not going to give him anything." Those guys saved Social Security.
Yeah, Curd Carruthers sitting on the floor of the Senate, Senator Curd Carruthers, Republican Oklahoma, eating 18 Chick-fil-A sandwiches during an 18-hour filibuster, saved Social Security for another generation.
God
bless
Curd
Carruthers and Senator Gernt Gutwell.
They're like the right-wing equivalent of the full communism type people, right?
Yeah.
They're like, this
absolutely.
Yeah.
They're right-wing tankies.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Thank God.
Blorch Florply, thank you.
And you know what's
funny?
Yeah,
I love you.
You mentioned about lowering expectations, and that's an incredibly important part of the Democratic Party's messaging. I mean, I have that quote in my article from Barney Frank saying, like, you know, the likelihood of a coal miner becoming a solar engineer is, frankly, is nil. But that's like, okay, yeah, that's because you want it to be. There is literally nothing stopping it's not impossible that we could have a giant WPA.
Well, I mean,
What
is the next sentence in that line? You fucking just bury them all in a fucking, used up coal mine?
Well, that's what they're
just
doing.
Just shoot them in the head and fucking put dirt over them?
I mean, it blows
my
mind.
What the fuck is your answer to that?
This inability, I mean, like, there's, when he said that, I was like, well, why the fuck not? You could literally, this could be done. There's nothing stopping this. And people say, well, you know, 60 votes in the Senate. But if the Democratic Party wanted to do that, they could fucking do that. They could have a $2 trillion WPA to fucking train people in a matter of weeks to get them, you know, becoming the solar engineers and updating our infrastructure for the coming climate collapse. Like, they just don't want to. So they say, oh, they've got to go, you know, pay $1,000 a month for their Obamacare and have, you know, like, that's, the, like, what, exactly, like, what are they supposed to do? Apparently, they're just supposed to sit there and drink themselves to death.
They have sort of a holistically evil view of the world, because going back to this conversation I had with this neoliberal guy who suddenly discovered intersectionality in 2016, when we were arguing about the Saudi, how we sell so many arms to Saudi Arabia, he said, well, okay, Mr. Support the Workers, you're gonna eliminate jobs if we can't sell F-16s to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And I said, I don't know if you've driven on a fucking road in the last 10 years, but there's a lot of work we could do there. There are bridges that fall apart all the
fucking
time.
In fucking Minneapolis, you know? This is one of the most well-funded...
There is a plan. I think that the current Clintonite wing of their party has a plan, a make-work plan, where they spend a lot of money to just buy and produce massive numbers of opiates and then drop them by planes onto the middle of America so that the largest possible number of disemployed white people can overdose.
Yeah, hey, they've watched Justified. They know what it's like. They know what's going on out there.
By the way, Boyd Crowder was a Bernie supporter. He said, well, Raylan, I don't know why you've been so loquacious with me. It's just a little social democracy.
Oh, Boyd Crowder silenced in 4 WOC when one would do. Boyd, I will give you 3 seconds to be ready for her, or I will put you down myself.
I can't believe Raylan has not become the southern equivalent of Justin Trudeau. Like, with, like, a series of memes of Raylan, you know, talking about like, you know, how woke he is or something. I they really missed the boat on that because he's, you know, he's sexy. He's a good looking guy.
He's like,
it's perfect.
If you wake up and harass one person, chances are you're probably an asshole. You're harassing people all day. Chances are you're a Bernie bro.
Chances are you're a Jackman editor.
Before I ever went to Quantico, before I ever went to the farm, my dad was reading me bell hooks. I was learning how to check my privilege and amplify voices long before I ever got this fucking badge.
Oh man,
we check privilege together.
Oh man, sorry. Just we're adding this now into the Chapo scripts. The Chapo movie pitches is woke justified.
Why Raylan? This swastika you see on me is just a remnant of my past. I am not white. I am red. He's like Boba Vakian. Boyd is now played by Boba Vakian.
Oh, God.
Oh,
fantastic.
Man. Woke Justified would be
would
amazing.
Watch that
I can't
show.
Wait for that.
Yeah. They need to reboot it right now. But, I mean, I guess going back to what I said earlier, I just think that, like, The most positive thing for me about Bernie Sanders and what he's done, and even if he were to become president, like the rejoinder to this idea about, you know, we need to get things done, quote unquote, these vague things that just need to do that only, you know, someone with the experience and ideology of Hillary Clinton can accomplish, is what's more important than getting things done, in my opinion, is, like you said, is to raise people's expectations about what is politically realistic in this country, or like just to kind of broaden the aperture of our imagination.
And then maybe you can get people to fucking show up at a midterm election.
Yes.
If they have something on the ballot to goddamn vote for.
No, I agree. I mean, this is raising expectations is dangerous for the ruling class. I mean, you could argue that's the French Revolution was a good example of people had high hopes going into the kind of the in 1788, 1789. And then when the kind of like ruling class put the brakes on that, they, you know, they blew up, right? It was a revolt. So I think raising – this is why I – you know, when kind of ultra-leftists are like, oh, but Bernie's program is just the New Deal. I'm like, they don't understand that just delivering on one of those major things, just one, would – it would not – they wouldn't be like, well, we got Medicare. I guess that's it. We'll see you later. Like that would just embolden people to go further and further. I mean – The Meidner plan in Sweden, which basically would have transitioned Sweden to an actual something close to a social society. I mean, that didn't happen. You know, when that occurred because people had decades of winning reforms and raising expectations. Right. So that kind of thing just sets off a positive chain reaction. So. That's really important to remember, that it is important for these people to shape expectations downward. It really is.
Okay. I wanted to run this by somebody from Jacobin just because of the historical resonance. I still, and I think everyone on the show agrees, that if we were going to throw money in a pot on who's going to win in November, we'd probably put the money on Hillary. But the thing that kind of gives me pause is that several people have pointed out online that if you were to punch to the date of election day, 2016, into a French Revolutionary calendar, you will find out that it is actually the 18th of Brumaire.
Right.
And that kind of gives a chill, because when I think of Trump, I really don't think of any of these comps people are doing, like Hitler or Mussolini or even George Wallace, relative to Louis Napoleon. That's the guy I think of, because when Marx wrote 18th Brumaire of Louis Napoleon, like, he spent a lot of time talking about the French peasantry, who are the guys who ratified Napoleon's coup in the plebiscite. And he had the famous line about how the peasantry was a sack of potatoes, by which he meant that when you bring them together to express their opinions, they are not going to act in a conscious, class-conscious manner. They're going to act as just the way if you bring a bunch of potatoes together, they would just all be separate potatoes, because the way that they worked and their livelihoods did not interact with each other in such a way that it would generate class consciousness. And when I think of the American electorate in 2016, I really think of that sack of potatoes, in the way that we are in this weird post-industrial world where people don't work in factories the way that Marx envisioned or the way that production happened in the United States in the early 20th century. And media has totally overwhelmed community. And I feel like we kind of are the sack of potatoes again, only it's like we're a bunch of Pringles in a tube.
Well, they're
you heard it here first, folks. Matt Crispin slandering the American voter as, quote, a bunch of Irishmen.
I think there's, yeah, I mean, but at the same time, the Democratic Party works really hard to make that the case, right? Like, I think there's a huge amount of solidarity that's come out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. I mean, look at the Verizon workers strike that, you know, they won.
They kicked really ass. Won.
They kicked ass, and they kicked ass because of something unusual happened. Is they went on strike when a popular socialist was running for president and, you know, supported them and was vocal about it. So I think that, like, it's not these things. This is a choice. The ruling class wants to make it this way. Like, I don't think that we're so atomized that we couldn't have, that we couldn't build solidarity, that we couldn't have a revitalization of the labor movement. I think just the ruling class wants to prevent that from happening. They want the election to be, you know, a bunch of, you know, asshole right-wing fanatics versus a calm, technocratic, and polite liberal politician. They don't want, you know, they don't want any kind of, like, class politics. They're doing everything they can to prevent that.
But do you think Donald Trump is, in his own way, advertising? Like, is he pitching a kind of class politics in a way?
I mean, yeah, in a weird way. The studies on, like, who his support is, it seems kind of all, you know, it's not as defined. Doesn't it seem to be like kind of a middle class, and he definitely does seem to be getting,
like, he does the best in, like, the poorest counties,
but amongst the richest
but
people
amongst
in
that,
those
yeah,
counties.
Yeah.
I think what it comes down to is, yes, these are people who live in shitty areas, but they are people who themselves have a degree of material security and are voting Trump out of anxiety about losing it because they are seeing where they could be. And that is what's doing it. Like, they themselves are not in absolute immiseration, but they see it because they live in these terribly poor counties, and that freaks them out. And they want somebody to come along and save them, and that's Trump.
No, and later on, Christine said that doesn't convey luxury, and I said to Jen, I said, yeah, that probably does not convey luxury. I would like to do it, but I'm not the Lexus customer. I'm white trash. I only eat at restaurants with deep-fried appetizers. So I know I'm not the Lexus.
What do you mean you're white trash?
Well, I'm just joking about that.
What does that mean? You don't joke about that. What does that mean you're white trash?
I grew up in a small town, and
does that
I'm
make
not
you white trash? Do you feel you're white trash?
Sometimes
that's
I do.
That's a pretty stinking statement.
I was a little,
don't you think that's a pretty bad statement about yourself?
No, not necessarily. I don't think people take that seriously.
It doesn't sound flattering.
Do you go around calling yourself white trash?
As a joke.
Do you think I
want to
hire somebody that's white trash?
No. No, I say it as a joke sometimes. And
I don't like it as a joke. You know what, Derek? You're fired. I think that is so stupid for you to say, you're fired.
Okay.
Go.
All right.
Terrible. You shouldn't use that expression anymore either.
Well, this is, I mean, okay, so we've been talking about, like, the Democratic Party and Bernie versus Hillary, but I want to get into the other half of this now, and we have been talking about it, but Trump, right? Okay, he's a Republican nominee. There's a fairly real chance that he could be our next president. And what I want to ask you about now is, like, okay, so last week we've been seeing, you know, some more of this sort of, you know, fisticuffs at Trump's rallies, and for all we've been saying about, you know, how racism is used against, as a cudgel sort of against the white working class, you know, I don't think it's controversial to say that a lot of Trump's appeal is basically racist. I mean, is that going
of
too
course.
Far?
No, I think that's certainly a big part of it, but if you listen to his speeches, I mean, that's certainly a part of it, but he's like a nationalist, like,
yeah,
he's like talking about a national resurgence, and like I think he definitely does appeal to these racist types. But, you know, I mean, he hits Hillary from the left on foreign policy. He talks about how we got to bring back manufacturing, so he kind of mixes in like a George Wallace appeal with a kind of like Ross Perot you know, it's really strange. And it should be pointed out that Trump is, he's only popular when you pit him up against one of the most unpopular politicians in America. So, like, in a weird way, like, I'm happy to talk about Trump, but I think so much is being made out of this guy. This guy who, if a socialist, if the beloved socialist candidate was in the race, would cream him, right? Like, he's only does so well because he's...
Well, hold on a minute, though.
Despised.
You say that, but Bernie has not been vetted. We haven't seen the GOP machine go after him in such a way that would destroy his base of support. You know, all that shit that Hillary's been saying for months and months, but if Republicans said it too, it would totally undermine his popular support.
And, you know, Matt Karp from Jackman did a good job of showing how that's not even true, right? That by spring, people kind of have fixed ideas about a candidate. So with Obama, all the Reverend Wright stuff, you know, and I, you know, I was an Obamaphile at the time, so I was kind of like, oh my God, this is going to, you know, he's not going to win now. But it didn't actually do much to his favorability numbers because people knew who he was and they had an idea of who he was. So this idea that people are suddenly going to turn on Bernie, it's not supported by the facts. Like, people compare that to Dukakis, but Dukakis was like the Democratic Party's, and Matt said this in his article, he was like their John Kasich, right? Like, he was this guy that no one really knew, and not, he had a really low, people didn't actually know who he was, and they thought he seemed okay. So when the GOP machine went after him, they were able to define him because he wasn't really well defined in the first place. You could not say that about Bernie Sanders in June.
No, he's like the second or third, at this point, the second or third most well-known politician in America right now.
Exactly.
The idea that he's like some guy who's coming out of nowhere and who could be redefined at this late stage, yeah, that's absurd.
I mean, I keep hearing that, like, well, you know, just don't underestimate how scary the word socialism is to the average American. God. And it's like, well, couldn't you have said, you know, quite plausibly, I think how scary the name Barack Hussein
Obama Barack Obama.
Is.
Exactly.
Clinging to guns and religion. Reverend Wright. Bill Ayers.
Goddamn America.
Worked, if that shit worked, Obama would have been murked in 2008, and he wasn't.
He won
which
quite
tells
convincingly.
You that shit doesn't fucking work.
I mean, the main issues for independent voters are, one, harassment on Twitter, two, the Sandinistas, and three, support for Benjamin Netanyahu. These are three things that every voter really gives a shit about.
Exactly.
I have not left Manhattan in 3 decades.
I guess this is a better way of bringing up the Trump thing. Like, and this is why I want to ask you, like, what do you make of now, like, these spates of articles that we're seeing from a lot of, like, the sort of big names in the liberal media and also in the conservative media, like, at least on the neoconservative side, this idea that Trump is a fascist and that, like, this idea that on one hand, Trump represents a sort of completely unique threat to democratic norms in America, but then on the other side, him and his supporters should be treated with exactly the same civility and respect as any other Republican or Democratic candidate for president.
Oh, it's absurd. I mean, first of all, I just want to say that I think that it's not always tactically wise to go out and pick street fights with Trump supporters. So I'm not really 100% behind that, but it is really funny because they've been saying, you know, he's a Nazi, he's going to, you know, it's going to be the fascist America, and then to stand back and be like, well, you don't start a fight with them. I mean, like, well, if they're actually, you know, if he's actually a Nazi, then people are just listening to what you define him as. I don't think Trump is a fascist. Like, the Democratic Party has been using this line to discipline the left since, at the very least, 1964, right? And I gotta say, I think that Barry Goldwater was a lot scarier than Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So,
I
think John Kasich in some ways is scarier
than
Donald Trump.
Yeah, no, John Kasich wants to put... No one fucking remembered this, but John Kasich, the sane choice, they even said during the debate, John, take us around the world in your first 120 days. And what he described was like fucking lunacy. He goes, well, as we know, the Shia Muslims are our natural enemy. And people cheered. Then I'm going to put the 87th Mountain Division in Finland to provoke a border confrontation. I was like, what the fuck is this? This dude is a fucking maniac. He would cause World War III in the first 4 months unless the DOD revolted against this fucking war-hungry drifter.
The thing about fascism is
one of the last three people on stage.
Fascism, like an old leather glove. I think John Kasich is disgusting because
fucking awful.
This idea that Kasich is the reasonable choice. It's every time I hear that, my brain just explodes. I mean, his record in Ohio. I mean, he's like goes to war with labor. Tries to revoke. Like, didn't he make it much more difficult?
Yeah, he's like set women's health care back by about a century.
Yeah, abortion, this guy's right. Disgusting. I mean, people like that scare me a lot more than Trump. If for some reason Trump became president, I mean, he'd be going into office with everybody, especially the elite class, being like, don't take this guy seriously. He's disgusting. How did this happen? People like George Bush are scary when everybody's like, you know, they kind of rally around him. They think he's a really serious person.
And this is a point that, you know, I know I've made before on this show, and we were sort of alluded to it in the beginning of this conversation. But like, I don't really have a whole lot of fear about, like, you know, the coming Fourth Reich in America, because like I actually remember what it was like living in this country in 2003 when George Bush landed on that fucking aircraft carrier.
The thing about fascism is that fascism is the political realization of the death drive. Right, it's a bunch of people traumatized by economic reality and the horrors of war deciding, fuck it, we're going to fucking put our feet on the pedal to 150 until we crash into a brick wall. Whereas most Trump supporters, if you were to give them the option, are you going to vote in November or would you like a diet soda that had full flavor? They would take the soda. Like, we just are too comfortable to be fascists in this country.
It also requires
a degree of desperation that even in this, you know, precarious state we're in, we just aren't at yet.
Our fascists, every confrontation that they've had in the streets, they've just gotten the shit kicked out of them.
Right.
I don't know, like, imagine, I mean, our fascists tried to block, they had a plan to block DC's highways by driving their trucks around and they couldn't even get it together. Like, a beer hall putsch would end with like a 50, like a 500 page forum thread about,
like, yeah, where
like guys yelling at each other about emailing each other's wives,
you know,
like,
right. And what was the result? What was the result of the San Jose violence? It was a bunch of guys doing memes on Facebook being like, wow, oh, I thought free speech was acceptable to the left. Like, I can't imagine fucking stormtroopers pulling that shit in 1928, you know, on the streets of Berlin.
This is why, getting their
head caved in by a Red Front fighter and going, wow, so much for liberal tolerance.
Right.
These fucking guys have been talking about, like, putting people in helicopters and throwing them into the ocean and putting them in gas chambers for a year. And then, like, somebody got punched and they go, well, I don't even feel safe anymore. almost everyone in America, they're a bunch of fucking pussies talking
again,
each game,
you know,
that they'll never back up.
We covered this with Carl Baer back in episode 5, I think.
Yeah.
But again, like, whenever you hear people, like, especially like ostensible liberals, you know, intoning darkly about, like, you know, like the unseemly forces that are going to be unleashed, and like these scary people talking, as always, they won't do shit. They're not going to do shit. I don't care how many guns they have.
Well, go back and look at what the liberals were saying in the 90s about the militia movement. I mean, they were honestly, in that in some ways seems a lot scarier, right?
Oklahoma City happened during that era.
Yeah, they actually killed a few hundred people.
Yeah, liberals were like trying to sell that, oh, the fascists are at the gates. I mean, this is, I have something a lot, you know, scarier than the fascists at the gates. More of the same. Right? Yeah. Like, things are horrible right now. I mean,
the evil, the evil is already here. The evil is when a fucking gaggle of cops shoot a 17-year-old kid to death in Chicago, and the Democratic mayor covers it the fuck up.
The evil
is here. The murder of fucking people of color and the state-sanctioned murder of people abroad and just every shitty fucking thing that happens. It's already here. It's already happening.
We have 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's prison population. We have something insane. We have one-third of the world's female prisoners. So when I hear this idea that, fascism, I mean, we don't even need to talk about that. Things are already horrible beyond belief. I mean, how many times are we going to read an article about the death rate is exploding because people are addicted to opiates and painkillers and drinking themselves to death. I mean,
Connor. We know about the death rate because it's white people that are dying. I'm glad you noticed that now.
What were we talking about before I started talking about
Trump is not really a fascist. Here's what I want to say. It's like, look, I don't want to get get into the woke but submental category. Like, I don't think anyone should fool themselves that like Trump would be like a positive thing politically country.
Like, I just want to make this clear. Like, I want Hillary Clinton to win. I really do. Like, the worse things get, the better has never actually.
That accelerationist shit is just like. Is like that's one rung above, and then the people will rise up with us. It's like, no, they fucking won't.
And just from the selfish perspective of being in the trap house, I know that we're gonna have way more fun banging on the shitty Hillary administration. I mean, what the fuck are we gonna do? Are we gonna be like Jon Stewart under Trump, being like, "Wow, did you see what Trump did this week?"
Yeah,
it's terrible.
The worst thing, if were Trump to become president, is that he would. I think he has no real interest in governing or politics at all, and I think he would be completely beholden to the agenda of the Republicans in Congress, which would be awful.
Right?
It would be terrible. I mean, Tom Cotton is already sort of moseyed up alongside of him, and you look at his advisors. You look at people like Waleed Faris, especially. Like, there's just some really fucking disgusting people that would be running the show.
Do we have any kind of record of what happens when a disinterested shithead becomes president and surrounds himself with a bunch of advisors who then write the agenda? I wonder what that would look like.
Hold on. Let me put on my Arthur Chu hat. When Tommen Baratheon became king of Westeros, what happened was more influence from Kevin Lannister. And you can see that Trump is sort of like Tommen and Joffrey mixed with Roose Bolton. And if we want to bring in the Harry Potter universe, it's basically Hufflepuff versus Slytherin. And also there's speaking Klingon.
Arthur, why is your face so wet? What's going on?
You're blocked.
Okay. All right. I think that's probably a good place to wrap up this conversation.
Yeah.
But I think we can say both a Hillary and a Trump presidency would be awful, but a Hillary presidency is likely to be awful in a way that is more constructive
productive.
Trump presidency is just nihilistic Verhoeven movie awful with no.
And one last word on that. Remember how the broad left to center was when Obama came to office? They were in tears. They were so happy when he would do these shitty things. They'd be like, "Well, give him a chance." When Hillary Clinton comes into office from day one, it's going to be fuck you.
And think how good it'll be for Jacobin.
It'll be great for Jacobin.
At least half of the people who are going to vote for Hillary are going to have like zero willingness to cut her slack when she becomes president.
That's a more productive relationship than the kind of like in awe of Obama shit from 2019.
Yeah, I love the people who posted pictures of Obama in sunglasses and they're like, Republicans are hating on him because they're not him. And it's like, you would vote for a Vine star. Like, that's how fucking stupid you are. You would vote for fucking Jacob Sagittarius, that like 13-year-old who makes rap songs.
No, Lauren Laveau.
The reason that electoral coalitions don't come with erasers is that you can't erase what's in voters' hearts.
Okay. All right, we're back. Once again, that was Connor Kilpatrick of Jacobin Magazine talking to us about why Hillary Clinton is ready to be our next president and we should all support her.
Yeah, Connor did convince us to reroute all the money from our Patreon to Hillary's campaign. So thank you, Grey Wolves. You have supported the biggest cracking in the glass ceiling in history.
So just whenever you think of that Patreon money, just imagine Mark Penn just housing salami.
He
made that possible.
It will also go to James Carville's face sharpening treatments.
and Peter Dow's next shipment of Kalashnikovs.
And I was going to make a Tom Watson joke, but then I realized, like, there's not, like, I can't even picture Tom Watson enjoying anything. I just see him, like, sitting.
It's getting Tom Watson another sort of, like, pastel-colored quarter-zip fleece, maybe?
Yeah, he's the most boring thing. I like, set myself up for a joke, and I was like, what does... I immediately started imagining what Tom Watson does, like, for fun, and I just pictured him sitting on a folding chair, dipping a carrot into a glass of warm water.
So, to follow up on our interview with Connor, we want to read briefly now from this is sort of I found this article. It's on Medium last week, and I think it's sort of the quite an exemplar of a certain genre of article that's circulating now from the sort of I used to love Bernie Sanders, but now I don't, and like Bernie. Do better. You've let us all down. Genre of articles, and I want to read from it briefly, just sort of as a coda to our conversation with Connor. Like I said, I found this on Medium, and the title of the article is "The Bernie Sanders I Thought I Knew Is Gone." It's by a woman named Sasha Stone. And from what I can tell, it's 100% real and not a joke. So
she's one of those incredibly self-important Hollywood bloggers. Like, she writes about the Oscars all year round.
Okay, so this is how a person who writes about the Oscars year-round writes about politics, okay? So I'm just going to... She opens the article here with, "How must it feel to feel like a god? Bernie Sanders knows. At the end of each of his debates with Hillary Clinton, he never turned toward her or the news anchors. He always turned to his cheering, adoring fans, soaking up the sunbeams of their love each and every time. Who wouldn't?" Okay, so this is already it indulges one of the weirder tics of this kind of person's thinking is this whole thing about like Bernie's body language at the debates being like a matter of great importance and symbolism to them. You know what I mean?
Did you guys think it was sexist when like Hillary was trying to talk about Dolores Huerta and Bernie took off his shirt and drank an entire gallon of milk? Like, I think that revealed a lot about him.
That thing where he hung brain for the entire foreign policy section of the first debate, I thought that was really in poor taste.
Yeah, the constant readjusting of his nutsack during the minimum wage debate. Like, do better, please.
Okay, she goes on. "Who is the real Bernie? Is he not the guy I once thought he was? The guy whose videos I watched, who was always ready to give voice to the anger many of us felt whenever Republicans blocked any progress Democrats tried to make. I begin to ask myself, how could that guy be getting so few endorsements from his colleagues anywhere in Congress? Why does that Bernie Sanders act like he doesn't have a son? Why does this Bernie Sanders treat his own wife so disrespectfully? Finally, why does this Bernie Sanders seem unable to face the reality that he has lost the primary to Hillary Clinton?" Okay, two things right there. What is the thing about his son and his wife? Can you guys parse that?
I can't.
I pay an unhealthy amount of attention to this shit, and I have no idea what the fuck she's talking about.
Yeah, but he has a son from a first marriage, right?
Yeah.
And he doesn't figure on the campaign trail with him?
"I consider my first son a mistake. I am not a betting man, but I would put a dollar or two on the proposition that my failure son has not fucked."
Okay, Bernie Sanders' first son has never fucked, and he treats his wife mad disrespectfully. He's got her on lock. He's like, he's got like, my house, my rules.
I guarantee you.
No, hell no.
Bernie Sanders has like he has a man cave, and there's a big plaque on it that's just like, only eat bacon, will be scratching my balls, only sports. You know, like, that's what I'm watching. I touch the remote.
Whenever Bernie Sanders' wife wants to watch The Bachelor or other programs that women enjoy, Bernie immediately puts on the Adam Carolla podcast.
I'm going to continue reading. She says, for Bernie Sanders, mostly dismissed or largely unnoticed in the 35 years he held political office, living comfortably off the good graces of taxpayers, to have at least have massive numbers of people listening to him must feel like a very big deal. This is a guy whose ideological purity has found little traction in a bipartisan government that exists through collective compromise and evolves through incremental change.
Oh, so hi, Carla Digler.
She got in the line there about how he's only had a government job, living off the taxpayers.
That's a solid liberal critique, totally.
That's a solid own, yeah. Like, what's his stock portfolio look like? How's he going to retire on that? Is he going to retire off his wife's money? Did she make all the dough in the family, and now he's going to leech off of her? All the same, it must have irked Sanders that this woman who had gained prominence as the wife of Bill Clinton rose so fast to be elected senator from New York and then swiftly proceeded to get things done. What did she get done as senator?
A little thing called the invasion of Iraq.
No, but in terms of like domestic legislation that she actually sponsored and passed, I think it was some bill about video games.
She co-sponsored a bill banning flag burning.
Yeah, I think she did.
I bet Bernie wishes he could have done that.
Folks, it goes on and on and on. I'm gonna skip to the end here. He writes, "You see, for Bernie, it's still all about Bernie. It's still about a god's rise. He's like the Persian king in 300, yeah. Basically. though it will take some time for his most rabid supporters to be deprogrammed, what will finally stand as the biggest stain on the Sanders legacy is the way he directly tried to undermine Clinton on the same day she went after Donald Trump most forcefully, in what will certainly be remembered not only as her best speech to date, but probably among the best political speeches ever given."
This woman fucking rules.
I need to read one more clip before I wrap this up, because this is another really good one. She writes, "Though tensions might have run high in 2008, as poll numbers show us, neither Hillary Clinton nor Barack Obama ever engaged in such sloppy, cruel, abusive, and destructive anything to win tactics. They both maintain a level of dignity and civility, a nicety Sanders has conveniently abandoned in the cry for revolution." Do you remember the 2008 primary between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama?
"He continues to spend millions of dollars perpetuating falsehoods. So shame on you, Barack Obama."
Yeah, she was the one who leaked that picture of him in the tribal garb.
They leaked that picture of him dressing like Toadstool from Mario Brothers, holding hands with some Indonesian imam that was on the front page of the New York Post, like the day after he won South Carolina.
You don't believe that Senator Obama's a Muslim?
Of course not. I mean, that's, you know, that there is no basis for that. You know, I take him on the basis of what he says.
And you said you take Senator Obama at his word that he's not a Muslim. You don't believe that he's a Muslim.
No, why would I? There is nothing to base that on, as far as I know.
And then when she was asked to justify staying in, even though she was no longer mathematically possible to be the nominee, does that sound familiar to anyone? She's like, "Well, you remember what happened to Robert Kennedy at that point."
Who, yeah, am I right,
it was
folks?
It was the greatest campaign ever. Like, they sent Bill Clinton to say racist things in South Carolina for some reason. Like, it was the fucking best. Like, it was the most incivil Democratic campaign in probably the last, 30 years?
This lady is off her rocker. But so I'm just going to close out here. She writes, "He can't accept Hillary's rise in triumph. even if his denial risks the fate of the country. Has any politician in recent memory ever abandoned so much to achieve so little? The old Bernie, many of us once respected, is gone. He doesn't exist anymore, and maybe he never did. Maybe he has always been someone we all wanted to be. I was just going to say, the greatest trick Bernie Sanders ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist. And then like that, he's gone.
He's Kaiser Soze.
After he tanks Hillary's presidential campaign, he sort of like walks away. His limp vanishes. He sort of like flexes his muscle and then gets in a car with like Charles and David Koch and just drives off. Okay. I think it's time we close it out for this week. But instead of doing a duck hunt this week, we're going to give you a preview of what you will be getting if you subscribe now to become a Chapo Grey Wolf. If you subscribe now and become a Chapo Grey Wolf, you will get a premium episode this week where we will be hunting the duck, Al Giordano, and discussing his campaign to primary Bernie Sanders, a.k.a. the only political campaign from a nobody more worthless than David French.
Just a little preview. I'm going to preview my theory for how this campaign came to be. I think after me and Virgil put Scotty Burberry in a New York Magazine article, it caused him to go insane and like make 20 alts where he's like 20 different type of people. Like his current one is he's a black woman. But he replied to Al Giordano with all these alts and was like, I'm a Syrian refugee and I support you. I can't stand Bernie. And Al was like, wow, I have a lot of support.
Wow, Scotty Burberry single-handedly gaslit Al Giordano into becoming to doing the most pathetically failed Senate campaign in human history.
This is going to rule. I hope he actually does it, but we're going to talk about it in greater detail.
We're going to talk about Giordano.
With Twitter followers than most guys who just tweet about their balls all day.
Yeah, there are parody accounts like racist Bill Belichick who have like five times the followers that Al Giordano has.
Wait, that's not a parody account. That's Bill Belichick's actual Twitter.
Oh wow, that's clever of him.
Your nerd's gonna love that.
Yeah. Subscribe, become a Grey Wolf today. We'd love you to have you in our inner circle and in the premium shows. They're waiting for you. There's still room in this hot tub. Come in. I promise you won't get a rash. So we're going to go out this week. We're going to go out with a song. Last week we went out with that banging, that fire, tear up the club anthem, Knuck If You Cuck by Dem Whiny Boys. And this week we're going to go out with a different genre. We're going to go in the opposite direction and give you the country, summertime, good times, crack a beer, crack a Bud Light in your pickup truck with your best girl and her Daisy Duke cutoffs, summer anthem. It's Country Dad by Chud Truckley. This is going out to all the dads against daughters dating Democrats.
That's how you know how twisted this show is. Normies are all like, oh, I like all music except rap and country. At the Trap House, it's just rap and country.
We only like rap music.
Yeah, that's the real shit. That's the real shit.
Our ears are to these screets, and the screets are listening to rap music and country, and that's it.
Only.
So fuck all. Yeah.
Fuck EDM. Fuck classic rock. Fuck all that music. Fuck jazz. Fuck jazz.
All right, everybody. Till next week, we're leaving you with Country Dad by Chud Truckley. Till next week, guys. Bye.
Peace.
Bye.
In a small town, I was born and raised. Work real hard. I get paid. All the boys that my daughter dates have to suck me off. I'm a country dad. Don't break or bend. Do the F-150s over Mercedes Benz. Yes, sir, I've tasted all my daughter's boyfriends, 'cause I'm a country dad. Give me a can of domestic beer. I raised this daughter for 18 years. if I want to inspect her cooch. For cum, I think that's fine. I'm a country dad, don't break or bend. The F-150's over Mercedes Benz. Yes, sir, I've tasted all my daughter's boyfriends. 'Cause I'm a country dad.